Take a network break. Provision a virtual machine with a baker's dozen of virtual donuts and join us for our weekly review of tech news. We've got stories on Extreme, Avaya, Arista, Cisco, HPE, and more. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is the irrepressible Greg Farrow, and we're pleased to welcome our guest, Yvonne Sharp. We'll jump right into the news after a couple of sponsor messages. This week's show is being sponsored by Interop ITX, the only independent conference for technology leaders. It's taking place May 15th through the 19th this year. Get a year's worth of objective IT education in 1 week. Visit interopitx.com and use the promo code PacketPushers for a 20% discount. This episode is also being brought to you by ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on, from your data center to the cloud, so you can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of network issues wherever they occur. Sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/PacketPushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Story one, Extreme wants Avaya. Extreme Networks has bid $100 million for Avaya's networking business. Extreme CEO Ed Meyercord said the purchase will help grow Extreme's market share and customer base and predicts the purchase will add $200 million in revenue. Greg, what do you think?
$100 million sounds quite interesting, doesn't it?
It's a lot of money.
I think there's lots of things going on here. And this is actually probably much more complicated than it seems. First of all, remember that Avaya is in technical bankruptcy. So that's in the US, it's called Chapter 11, which means it's bankrupt, but it thinks it can trade its way out. And as we talked about, I don't know, 4 or 5 weeks ago when they went into Chapter 11, they're basically profitable business. They're selling stuff and making money, but they're saddled with a bunch of debt from that where it was fashionable to own companies, load them up with debt, and then put them back out on the market and see if they died. And Avaya, of course, is doing the dying bit quite well, because of the debt repayment. So it's restructuring its debt. So part of that being in bankruptcy means you've got to go to the people who you owe money to and say, here's how I'm going to get out of debt. And of course, the first thing that they say is, well, what can you sell? So you can give me cash now and give me my money. I want my money. I want out. And so you start looking around at the Avaya business and thinking, what can you sell? And the networking business has been rumored to be up and on the block time after time for the last 5 years. And this time it's definitely sold.
Yeah, there it is. Yvonne, any comments?
It looks to me like Extreme is looking for a customer list. When I read through their quotes, you know, Meyercord said it helps for us to have more reference accounts, more size and scale, more cross-selling opportunities. They're buying customers more than technology, is my opinion.
Well, they certainly are. Not only that, of course, Avaya sells call centers, big call centers at a time, you know, IP telephony, collaboration, online. They even have a GoToMeeting, Cisco Spark, Amazon Chime, Google Hangouts competitor as well. So they have all of these different products, and up until now, they've been wanted to keep the networking businesses so they can go in and sell the customer a complete solution from one vendor. And now they've got to let the networking business go because they have to pay down that debt. And so Extreme gets the business. More importantly, Extreme gets a business that has future sales attached to it, right? So when Avaya goes in and bids for business, it's probably going to lead with its own networking assets, which then Extreme gets to sell. As you said, it gets also access to Avaya's customers list, which is actually quite valuable, because a lot of those people aren't necessarily in the open market. If you've been somebody who's doing business with Avaya for 10 years, because that's all your business needs, then all of a sudden Extreme gets to go and land and expand inside of those. The other thing too here, perhaps, Drew, is that Whitebox might have had an impact here. We know that networking just isn't as important as it used to be, and that overall the enterprise Ethernet market is shrinking a little, just subsiding by a couple of percent per quarter. And obviously, Brocade hasn't been able to find a buyer for its Ethernet switching unit. So, you know, what are we seeing, this sort of shrinking in the enterprise, Whitebox taking away some of the market share or offering people alternatives? And so these actual networking businesses actually aren't worth much or actually aren't interesting to people.
Well, clearly it was interesting to Extreme. And I think Yvonne was right that they were shopping for a customer list. I listened to the investor call that Ed Meyercord had with investors, and he was very clear that the Avaya Fabric Connect has some loyal customers. We're not going to touch it. You know, we're not going to screw it up. We're going to continue to invest in Avaya. We know people like this technology, and we see this as an opportunity. Maybe we can sell something, get our edge products in there with Avaya, and maybe sell some management control monitoring software on top of that as well. So yes, definitely going for growth.
Yeah, they said that when they bought Enterasys. Go back and read the press releases when they bought Enterasys. They said exactly the same thing. We're going to keep it going, you know, with the something flow processor that they had. They did keep it going until no one actually bought it, and then they threw it away.
Yeah, if I were a Fabric Connect customer, I would be concerned.
Yeah, I would think that Extreme's going to switch them over to their merchant silicon switches pretty quickly, because it doesn't make sense to keep running two lots of silicon. But they will have to support SPB. That's the interesting part, because Avaya had a very successful and a lot of a very loyal following for SPB protocol when they were basically the last people left working on that, I believe.
That's right.
But also, don't forget that Extreme said that this is cash flow positive after year one.
Right.
So I think they're also picking up a lot of service contracts that are probably worth more than the sales part. Just keeping this product maintained is going to be a profitable business going forward.
Yeah, it's definitely a growth strategy for Extreme. All right, story two, HPE gets Nimble. HPE has announced it wants to buy Nimble Storage for $1.09 billion. Nimble sells an all-flash and hybrid array. It also has options to store data in AWS and Azure. I was reading a story from Chris Malore at The Register. He's reporting that Nimble will fit in nicely as a mid-range array offering underneath HPE's 3-par arrays.
Well, I'm not sure if it's going to be underneath or to replace 3-par, I think, Drew. I think you'll see that Nimble will be... The 3-par architecture is sort of like 15 years old and getting a little bit long in the tooth. And it was built in an era of hardware-based storage arrays and relied on a custom silicon in it to do a large number of the storage functions, which was what made it scale and perform so well. And today, of course, the future of storage is not in custom hardware and, you know, putting disks inside of custom chassis. It's about x86 boxes that have lots of hard disk drives in them and a piece of software on top. And we know that because HPE bought Simplivity just a few weeks ago for $650 million. Cisco bought, I can't remember what Cisco bought, but part of their HyperFlex strategy, the storage engine for their HyperFlex was a software-only storage, you know, so on and so forth. So I think that what we're seeing here is that Nimble Storage has an architecture which is suitable for scale-out. HPE can take its existing server portfolio, add the Nimble software on the top, and get a whole new software-driven architecture and move beyond the 3-par. So the 3-par would now be seen as... That's the old fixed storage array, and the future is going to be Nimble, which is software-driven on flash-ish.
Yeah, flash or hybrid.
But you're going to buy HP servers of certain flavors and then put your Nimble software on top of it, and now you've got a scale-out storage array with all of the features that you want. That's the hole in the HP storage line, I would think.
I thought it was interesting to see that Nimble, they've been growing in revenues but still have been losing money. It looks like that's a pretty good purchasing strategy, though. Grow in revenue. You don't necessarily have to make money if you can be interesting enough to somebody who wants to buy you.
Yes. I think there's many things about this deal. Of course, the fact is that Nimble's culture would fit in with HPE. Sometimes HPE has bought companies that don't, how shall we say it, fit in so well. And integrating them hasn't worked out quite so well. You know, like, for example, EMC has gone out and bought Isilon, VMware, DSSD, Data Domain, and then tried to, you know, mash them together and call them one product. And you end up looking like a wrecking yard where you've got a bunch of different chassis sitting out the front, but you're saying they're all one product line. And that's not really what it is. I think Nimble does actually fit in. I think it's a very good move overall. And most people have said the same.
And certainly seems to fit in with HPE's decision to focus on the enterprise. This is the market they want to go after. They want to have a sort of new, refreshed product line because they sold off a bunch of old businesses. And so this is part of their acquisition strategy, just to present sort of a new HPE.
Yeah, I think this is HP is going to reinvent itself, which is exactly what it needs to do. It needs to, you know, got rid of all those legacy BUs and now it's modernizing and making acquisitions, but these are infrastructure focused. So in a very real sense, HP is still betting that enterprise infrastructure is the future. Oh, and cloud infrastructure too, but, you know, enterprise cloud infrastructure in particular.
All right, story three, Arista puts EOS in a container. Arista has announced a containerized version of its EOS network operating system. This version, which is called CEOS, can run on Arista top-of-rack switches or on third-party white box switches.
Well, color me funny. Like, I mean, what the... This is Arista, right? All the times we talked about Arista over the last, you know, 2 or 3 years of doing this podcast was, you know, they do it on hardware, and the reason they sell the hardware is because the hardware is where the big money is, right? You can shift... And every time we've talked to Arista about, you know, why don't you make EOS available for people to run on white box? And fair dinkum, I would have thought you'd had to call an ambulance and get them for some medical attention. And just like.
They did not like the idea.
No. Our value is very much about using merchant silicon and putting our software and selling it as a sealed unit that everybody wants. And that's what our customers are asking, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sort of asked the question several times. And so for them to suddenly basically in the announcement say, you can now buy EOS as an app that goes on top of a Docker container, on top of an operating system inside of a switch is like, wow, that's what it is, right?
Yeah, this just goes to show us that software is where it's at, that all the intelligence in our networks is going to be in software, not hardware, and the software matters. The hardware is coming more and more of a commodity. We've talked about that a lot, but this is just more evidence that even Arista, who has made a big deal about selling their hardware, is reading the tea leaves and sees that in the future. So at the very least, they're hedging their bets or looking to the future. We'll see which one that turns out to be.
Well, Greg, you and I sat down with Arista. We had a briefing from them, and they were very clear that this move was driven by a couple of big customers who are doing continuous integration, continuous development. They've got orchestration platforms. They want to manage their top of rack switches like they manage servers. And so they were looking for a more containerized form factor rather than, it's not necessarily about white box. It's about supporting this kind of infrastructure operational model. And that's where Arista went. And sort of the byproduct of going this way is that you can also now get Arista EOS on a white box.
Yeah, that's right. Now, what is important to understand here, I think, and I only twigged to this yesterday when I was reviewing and preparing for the show, was Arista has definitely presented this as, we're selling this as a container engine support for a specific type of software-centric. What they're not saying in their marketing documentation is that enterprises can now buy EOS for whitebooks, because that's not what it is. What you're actually buying is EOS as a container. And inside of that container is Arista's EOS apps. It is literally, it's BGP stack, it's DANs, and it's tooling, it's AEM, and the ability to program the drivers on a switch hardware, right, regardless of the type of hardware it is. I mean, it'll only work on determined pieces of hardware because they only support a limited number of ASICs. And we did ask them about their ASIC support, and what they pointed out was that they'll support ASICs that they're currently supporting in their own hardware.
Right, it's a Trident family, Tomahawk, and one more that I forget. But
yeah, the Cavium Helix.
Yeah, Helix.
And I think there's some of the Intel ones are in there as well. But anyway, for now, I think it's going to be Broadcom because that's really the only white boxes that are being made. But what's happening here is the customer still has to choose its Linux. They have to run their own Docker. They still have to run their infrastructure management agents, and they have to provide, and then they can install EOS in an app. It's not like you can run out today and say, I'll have an EOS, an Arista EOS license, please. You have to be somebody who's willing to do all this other stuff, like roll your own operating system. I think my reeling of it is you're going to roll your own Linux operating system. You're going to cut Docker and do Docker according to your corporate standards. And then EOS is going to run in a container. This is not something that those people in the enterprise are suddenly going to go out and say, I want an EOS. I'm going to buy a white box and get an EOS put on top, because that's not what's being sold here.
Yeah, it seems very clear that they're not trying to emulate like a Cumulus or a Big Switch. They are, first and foremost, we want to sell you Arista software on a box.
On Arista hardware.
On Arista hardware that we've blessed and certified. They did say that if you want to use CEOS, there's going to have to be some testing and certification because of the fact that they've separated EOS from the Linux kernel. So if you're throwing another kernel in there, then you've got to make sure it's actually going to work and interoperate correctly.
That's right. So we want to sell you a network mainframe, the hardware, the operating system, the applications, and the maintenance contract, all from a single vendor. But there's a few of our customers, and they matter enough to us for whatever reason, that they can have EOS in a container. So they can just have the apps, right? Not the operating system, not the hardware, just the apps on that. And the apps are, you know, the BGP, the open config engines, you know, all that stuff that we talk about specifically from SDN. That's what's being sold in this product, and I suspect it's not something that anybody can just go and sign up for, and nor is it something that anybody wants to go. It's not like you can go and get OpenSwitch, download the image, boot it up on your white box, and away you go. You've got an operating system and your apps. This is very much just the apps. So it's a big deal, I think, in the sense that it's validating the white box and the diversity of hardware that we're getting, and that there's enough demand coming from a segment of a market to transform the entire market. So the enterprise market is being transformed as well, because it's being dragged along by the changes of the megascale data centers, but not something necessarily that you as an enterprise engineer, who I think is the most people who listen to this show, are going to run out and buy.
Right. This seems like a toe in the water. Agreed. Not diving in. Yeah.
I'm not ready to roll my own operating systems quite yet. Maybe next week.
Maybe next week. All right, we've got to take a break to talk about our sponsor, Interop ITX. Greg, we're going to be at Interop with the Future Networking Summit. You want to tell us what's going on?
In the gorgeous Las Vegas, but this time in the MGM Grand Hotel, which is quite a nice hotel. And on May 15th to 19th, myself and Ethan Banks will be talking in our Future of Networking Summit, a two-day session where we actually unlock and tell you what we really think. Some people have accused me of being a little shy when I'm on podcasts and not really sharing my full intentions. The thing about being at Interop is that we can actually sort of unlock a little bit more in that one-to-one, face-to-face sort of mode of a conference speaking, where we can talk more about a single topic and deep dive. So join us for this two-day track where we deep dive into next-generation developments in the WAN, the data center, SDN data center, network operations and software-defined security. Now, there's more than just us, Interop, ITX. I would love you to come just for us. That's on the Monday and the Tuesday. But then on the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, the Interop then breaks out into the mainstream conference, and you can attend a range of other hands-on workshops and conference tracks. And the conference tracks are being run by people that you know from the social media community. Stephen Foskett and Tom Hollingsworth are running the networking track and so forth. And you can get stuff like security, DevOps, cloud, infrastructure, and more sessions going on through the week to keep yourself interested. So there's lots there to accelerate your career, lots of sessions on leadership and professional development. So if you feel that your personality needs a little bit of an upgrade, and hey, can't we all use a little bit of that? There's a whole bunch of that going on as well, a lot of soft skill stuff being working. So join us at Interop ITX this coming May. It's just 2 months away. Use the promo code PACKETPUSHERS when you register, and you'll receive a 20% discount. We want to see you in Vegas, so go over to interopitx.com and reserve a spot. Come and join us for the Future of Networking track on the Monday and the Tuesday, and then stay for the rest of the conference on the Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday.
Yeah, hope to see you there. All right, story five, Cisco splashed by WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks has announced a trove of information purporting to reveal malware and other spying tools that are being used by the CIA against smartphones, electronics, and networking gear, and some of that is targeting a variety of Cisco equipment.
It didn't just target a variety of it, targeted most of it. It seems like the three-letter agencies have actually gone after Cisco with a vengeance.
Well, you're the market leader. You're going to...
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the point. You know, they really sort of worked out ways to exfiltrate, to penetrate these devices, put configurations into them, and then start to exfiltrate data in a way that you're not going to see it. You're not going to know. They can create tunnels, and they actually spent a lot of time. The actual documents themselves not only showed you what they were doing, but how they spent a lot of time testing it to see if it would actually be a reliable way of extracting data, and it was.
That's right. They were doing QA to make sure that their intrusion didn't crash the devices, which is
that's
pretty good.
Now, it has to be said, this is all pretty sophisticated. There are implants. Some of them are hardware implants. Some of them are software implants. I spent a couple of hours clicking through the WikiLeaks stuff just to get a sense of how risky this is. Some of it is, you know, very easy to exploit. It's just basic configuration. Some of these Cisco devices date back to sort of the 2012-2014 timeframe, and so you've probably got them in your network. It's not like previous announcements have been on much older hardware. Some of this is actually quite modern. You know, sure, Cisco as the dominant vendor is definitely a target that you want to hit because one exploit can be widely applied. Like, there's a fair bit that, you know, everywhere. And I think we're just starting to see there's more documents to be released in the weeks ahead from WikiLeaks, so I think we'll see more from other vendors, compromising other vendors as well. Who knows? Maybe, maybe not. But it does seem clear to me that Cisco really hasn't done enough to harden their devices against these kind of threats. Now, I'm not necessarily critical about that, because if you can get physical access to these devices to put in your own image or to use a hardware implant to override something or to inject software into the Cisco iOS code, really, I think in this era, Cisco should have been working, or the vendors, all our networking vendors should be working on how to secure the images against external attack. They need to be hardened. This is a sign that I want to see vendors doing more around this thing. I mean, when you're up against nation state adversaries, you know, like the CIA, the NSA, the GCHQs, the Chinese government, it's probably acceptable that you're going to get pwned, because if you're in trouble with them, you've got a real problem.
One of the things I think this is going to mean for us in the enterprise, we hear a lot about workstation patching, about upgrading OSs, about putting security patches on workstations. And until now, our hardware platforms, our networking platforms have been insulated from that. I think we're going to see pushes now from our security teams to have a patching strategy for our networking equipment, which is not something that's easy to do with Cisco. And for our vendors, that's something they really need to help us with, right? Is how do we patch and update reliably these systems in a way that we're not afraid we're going to take down the whole network every time that there's a new security release?
Yeah, or that my company might go out of business every time I need to update my boxes. And that's still a problem today. I agree with that, and that's what I'm sort of pointing at, is that the vendors really haven't focused on this, you know, A, making their software secure and safe for us to use from even the most ordinary risk. We know how many bugs there are that keep causing problems. But they also haven't done anything to harden them against these types of security threats. The simple point of fact is that now this is out there, other people will have access to these exploits. You'll need to be talking to Cisco or reading the relevant Cisco security documentation to see what this means for them. I don't think too many of these are actually fixable, because they use code that is in iOS, especially the older iOS things, which if you remove them, the whole iOS will probably break, and or features would have to be removed completely. And of course, our vendors treat their network mainframes as a dumping ground for every single feature. That's trying to more like a dictionary than actually an essay on what you need, right? So it is kind of grim.
Another interesting fact is that Assange has actually come out and said that they're going to work with the vendors to provide them more detailed information before they release it so that they can work on providing patches, which is a bit surprising to me. Typically, WikiLeaks does their own thing without really caring about the downstream flow of how that's going to affect especially vendors. But I was at least pleased to see that they're going to provide the vendors a little bit of a heads up before they just release really technical details about how to perform
these exploits.
Yeah, exactly.
It does seem strange to sort of apply the term responsible disclosure to WikiLeaks. That's not their modus operandi.
Exactly.
I wonder, maybe the technology community got to them and was like, hey, you know, you're screwing a lot of people here. This isn't just fun and games about, you know, government intrusion. You're going to do some damage if you just dump these tools and exploit information onto the open.
Well, it's hard to know. Maybe they are growing up a little bit. But at the end of the day here, some of these vulnerabilities have got pushed out. And by the way, there was more than Cisco. There was TP-Link, there was D-Link, there was a bunch of other vulnerabilities listed out there. But it might be worth thinking about, this is your chance to actually just replace your network and rotate to a more modern platform. This is a good chance. Because if your systems are impacted by this, there actually maybe you'll never ever have the confidence that you've actually taken out the implants. Because a lot of these are non-removable. They actually exist in the BIOS. And every time you reboot the switch, even if you move to a new version, the BIOS is still there. So there's actually a fairly strong case to make that this gear should all just be thrown in the bin, not touched, not done, you know, should be turned off and taken away and burned with
some
fire.
Some of us have a whole lot of gear that's going to die anyway. Can you say clock cycle? So let's tie the two together.
Yes. It's a chance to get an upgrade, get something modern that's got less pain built into it.
But should organizations essentially just operate from the default assumption that our systems are likely owned by a nation state actor at this point? Is that seems like that's the default assumption we should just be working from these days.
If you ever come to the attention of a nation state type security mechanism, you are going to lose, right? They just
Absolutely.
Have too many resources.
Sure.
They have the power of the legal system against you. But the point here would be is that what Snowden showed us is that sometimes they act unwisely and they inject code into systems that shouldn't have it, and the systems often become unstable and tend to crash a lot, or they compromise things that they shouldn't be compromising. And if you're suffering because of that, and it's also possible that other nation state actors have worked out what these vulnerabilities are and are using those same hacks to exfiltrate corporate data, or maybe another government, a foreign government, is taking the data. So you actually need to fix these things regardless of whether, you know, you feel you're a threat or not. Right now, I'll bet there's a lot of people in Russia and Ukraine looking at this going, I wonder how I can hack into these so I can start getting access to people's data and use it to inject ransomware.
Exactly. Yeah, one of the things that happens is once you know something can be done, you're more likely to do it. And so now that this has been released, I think we'll see malware folks and people who have a lot to gain by compromising systems to know that these things are out there and to work to figure them out in ways that maybe they wouldn't have beforehand. So there's intelligence gathering from the nation states, but then in addition to that, there's what risk are we at now to further being compromised now that people know that it can be done.
Yeah. And these things just, you know, at a simplest level, if your systems have been compromised like this, they may be unreliable because, you know, making these changes in the code, and of course they haven't had vendor testing. That's one cause. Second thing is other people can come in and then start to steal data off them. And third thing is it's a good opportunity to say, you'll never know if you've actually removed the risk just by updating. Sometimes getting new code may not necessarily clean out the old thing. You'll never know what other implants that you don't know about are in there. So it's depending on your company's security posture, you're probably better just to switch these aspects off and throw them away and replace them with newer assets that are hopefully more modern and better developed by the vendors.
All right, moving on. Story 6, sticking with Cisco. Cisco is beefing up HyperFlex. They've announced an upgrade to their hyperconverged infrastructure product at the new to HyperFlex 2.5 or high-capacity all-flash drives, support for 40 gig per second UCS fabric networking. They've got native replication and self-encrypting drives for more security, and they're integrating with Cisco's Cloud Center, which is used to be named Clicker. We've talked about Clicker in the past, so that you can move workloads among private and public clouds.
Yeah, well, Clicker, and there's also a bunch of other tools in that Cloud Center product that have been folded in from a number of different acquisitions. There's four or five of them. I'm going to be a little bit negative about this, Drew, if I can. Can I do that? Am I allowed to sort of get after this?
I suppose.
So first of all, this thing still runs on 40 gig Ethernet, and everybody who's anybody has pretty much moved away from 40 gig Ethernet. So running hyperconverged infrastructure on 40 gig doesn't make sense to me. It should be 25 gig or 50 gig because that stuff is cheaper. If you're running 40 gig interfaces, that's actually costing you probably about eight times as much as a 25 gig interface or a 50 gig interface.
Well, Cisco's never been about cheaper.
No, true. Never there is the enterprise. But anyway, it's a bit old fashioned to be running 40 gig in 2017, I feel. And the second thing is that this report was actually commissioned by Cisco on the enterprise strategy group. And so you'd be really surprised when it said that Cisco's HyperFlex runs really fast.
Yes, of course.
So it's not that, and I'm not casting aspersions on Enterprise Strategy Group nor Cisco, but what vendors do is they make sure that the lab tests that are going to be run are the ones that look best for their hardware. It's very easy to do that. You know there's certain things that your hardware can do, so you make sure that the lab tests that are published are the ones where you look best. So I would just recommend to people to take this with a cautionary aspect. Yes, I believe that all of the x86 servers run more or less at the same speed. Arguing that one is 5, 10, 15, 20% faster than the other one isn't really going to get you anywhere when most of you are all going to be running on the same road at 35 miles an hour. It's like having the fastest Ferrari in the world and then driving it to work. It's just pointless.
Yvonne, any comments?
Nope, I got nothing.
All right.
Greg summed it up.
Just be careful when they claim these reports that say we're the best, and then you look at it and it says it was commissioned by the person who has a vested interest to say it's the best.
Yes, yeah. Cisco did roll out a report from Enterprise Strategy Group along with the announcement to say how wonderful this new version is. And of course, all those reports should be taken with maybe not a grain of salt, just put in a whole shaker. Cisco also said they've added 1,100 HyperFlex customers in less than a year, so a little chest thumping around HyperFlex adoption. Story 7, Juniper shakes it up. Juniper Networks has announced the departure of a top executive as it seeks to chart a more innovative path.
Again, another company having change forced upon them. Although at least Juniper's doing it from within, so they're changing themselves before they get forced to. Jonathan Davidson is originally a Cisco veteran and was hired on about 8 or 9 years ago. He was a really nice guy. He was hired on to revitalize the enterprise business, and Juniper for a while there was making inroads into the enterprise. And then suddenly it pulled back from the enterprise, and then it came and said, no, we're in love with the enterprise. And Jonathan Davidson was then moved sideways into innovation and development, and now he's been asked to leave the company. Oh, no, he resigned. So let's not cast aspersions where they don't need to be.
Right.
It's a little hard to read anything into this other than Juniper doesn't seem to have a reaction. So there's no SD-WAN story here. Where's Juniper's SD-WAN story? I'm pretty sure that BGP, MPLS, and segment routing is powerful and it's going to be amazing for a certain type of customer, but it's not what other SD-WAN companies would regard as a viable technology, or you know what enterprises are seeing from other SD-WAN companies. I'm not sure that that's what it is. So he's hoping that Juniper gets back on track to, you know, keeping its innovation engine going. I hate the word innovation, but keeps developing its products and keeps, you know, making progress in the market.
Yeah, there weren't, aside from Jonathan David stepping down, there weren't any significant changes at the top of the company. No executives are leaving other than Mr. Davidson. And they shuffled some organization charts about who's reporting to who. So this seems like Juniper just trying to say, we're working on it. We're going to have some great strategy, moving around some deck chairs. But yeah, we're going forward. We're going to be inventive and creative and hooray.
I did write it. It's moving around the deck chairs on the Titanic the first time around, because you do get the sense that Juniper's got some great technology and some great people. They've really got an opportunity to do something, but they don't seem to be able to, I don't know, exploit these things.
As I look at this, I mean, the enterprise networking cheese has moved and is moving, and everybody's trying to figure out where it's gone, where it's going. Is there less cheese? How do we chase it? And nobody knows exactly how that's going to shake out yet. And so they're just shuffling things around to see what sticks. That's kind of how I read this.
Juniper wants more cheese. Can we have some of your cheese, please? All right, let's take a quick break to talk about ThousandEyes, our other sponsor for today's show. As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. And that's a huge problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. That's the corporate network, the internet, cloud service provider networks, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network so you can put the two together. And this vantage point provides the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. So you can do things like piece together multiple layers of network insight from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. You can precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems like device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, hijacks, and more. You can share this data and insights with your vendors and your customers so you can resolve problems faster. And here's a special offer just for Packet Pushers listeners. You can sign up for a free account at thousandeyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see. Back to the news. Story 8, Juniper CPU clock woes. A few weeks ago, we had talked about problems with the Intel Atom, I think C2000 line that was bricking network devices, including products from Cisco, pfSense, and a few others. Now it turns out that a small number of line cards and some other gear inside Juniper's EX and MX lines have also been affected.
Yeah, so this is more just an informational thing. And I think we speculated when the initial announcement came out that this would affect a lot of other vendors. And if you actually head on out and do a Google search, you'll find out that it actually affects a lot of other vendors.
Right.
It does seem like people are being told to do a very specific thing. It has to be called a CPU clock component issue. So if you search on that word, and there's a sort of a stink of lawyers involved here, because the same syntax is always involved.
And the name Intel is actually never involved.
And Intel's name is never mentioned by the vendors. And yet in all the chat rooms and everything, everybody knows Intel C2000 Atom CPUs are the cause here, because that's where the clock problem is. But none of the vendors actually mention Intel or CPU. It's just a clock component issue. You know, that's just got lawyer stink all over it.
Yes, it does.
It is what it is. A lot of us have equipment out there that's going to die in some reasonable amount of time, and we're just going to have to deal with it. There's no pretty face to put on this problem.
Nope, and it's a great opportunity to throw out the old stuff and replace it with new stuff.
So the CIA and Intel are both giving you reasons to go to the boss and say, hey, you know what? Maybe it's time for an upgrade.
Yeah, it's time to throw those routers away and replace them with SD-WAN appliances from your favorite SD-WAN vendor. Get testing some, you know, Viptela or Telari or FatPipe or CloudGenix, you know, go and talk to them and see whether it's worth just going straight from moving off routers into something a bit more modern.
Yeah, I also hear that Juniper is trying to be more innovative, so maybe you could check them out too.
Yeah, yeah. And Meraki also. Cisco's Meraki is. Lots of people have had things to say this week to me about Meraki actually coming in with the goods in the SD-WAN space.
All right. Story 9, is Google the next cloud? Google recently held its Google Cloud Next event in San Francisco, touting new services and rolling customers on stage to talk up Google Cloud as an enterprise partner. Of course, we know that Google Cloud is still a third place runner behind AWS and Azure in the infrastructure as a service and other cloud service markets.
Yeah. So this is really only news in the sense that there was lots and lots of articles about this. And basically, Google spent the entire time saying, and we're definitely committed to this. We're not going to shut it down. Very defensively, you know, we know that you're an enterprise and you don't want us to offer you services and then shut them down in 6 months. And we know we've killed off like everything you ever wanted and everything you ever used. But hey, look, we're not going to do that ever again. The level of disbelief that sort of happened around that is substantial. Right. So the fact that they've hired an executive team and they're promising, they've got a lot of work in front of them to convince people that Google isn't going to give up on the enterprise in a couple of weeks. Just amusing.
I know that we're seeing top talent from other vendors leave their sales organization and go over to Google, which is interesting to me when I see key people who I've related with for other vendors move to a new technology. It's interesting. It at least makes me think, there may be something happening there.
Yeah.
That's a signal to you.
Yep.
What that tells me is that Google's spending a lot of money on hiring sales reps, high quality sales reps who have clients. Whether that will last more than 6 to 12 months, that's like what Palo Alto did with when it did a big burn, and Gigamon did this a couple of years ago and so on and so forth. They go out and hire all these high powered execs by offering them massive commissions, much bigger than the other people used to. They come in through the door and then of course the numbers pump up for a little while and then it's like, oh, that's not enough. And you know what? We're spending an awful lot of money on salespeople. Why are we doing this?
Well, I think when the enterprise looks at cloud, there's got to be a bigger strategy. I mean, one of Azure's big plays is for your developers, right? Here's a development platform that your developers use that works with the tools that they're used to, where they can develop and just make all this magic happen. I'm not sure quite what Google's hook is going to be there yet.
I think you're absolutely right that Google's play has to be more than just, well, we're Google. Of course you'll come to our cloud. You're absolutely right.
And I think the other thing here is that these clouds are all Lego blocks. The thing that I'm realizing is that these people aren't building solutions. The enterprise buys a solution. They don't go and buy a block of this and this Lego kit and this Lego kit and then assemble it themselves. Mostly what they do is they go to the vendors and say, I want to buy Cisco or HPE or IBM. I want you to guarantee me a solution. They do some self-assembly. But when you go over to Azure or AWS or Google, you get some storage and some compute and some services and some a CDN. And then you've still got to put all the blocks together and assemble it yourself. It's not suddenly a working solution that your company can make money out of until you've actually put all the Lego blocks together. So I do find, some of this cloud stuff a little bit amusing as people get over that. Now I've got my Legos, what do I do next?
In the enterprise, you have to have an uncommonly healthy organization to build things out of Lego blocks. I mean, it's hard enough to get an enterprise to make a decision on a full stack solution and to move toward that. When you have to piece all these different Lego blocks together across all the different silos and your entire IT infrastructure team has to be working in lockstep, that's a really, really difficult thing to accomplish in the enterprise for lots of reasons that aren't technical. and I think that's the challenge with cloud, right? Is like we don't know how to think about it. We don't know how to put those pieces together in a way that organizationally makes sense, that we can get everybody on the same page and moving in a direction without a vendor glad handing and rah-rahing and trying to chart a path for us. That's a problem that we have to solve.
Yeah, people are so used to the vendors saying. What I still think at the end of the day, the vendors promise you a solution and then deliver a product. So I'm not 100% convinced that even – how many times have you bought products from a company and said, no, right, now how does this work? Oh, it doesn't do what they actually said it was going to do. And that's
because
we
feel better about it, right?
Yeah.
It's not always about the technology. We feel like we're getting something for that because somebody bought us a steak dinner and some drinks.
Yeah, and maybe a golf and some golf clubs.
Well, maybe that's what Google needs to do, is charge 10 times more for its cloud computing services and throw some consultants in there with an expense account and go start drumming up some business.
Well, that's what Yvonne just said that they were doing.
Yeah. All right, story 10, Dell kills DSSD. Dell EMC said it's going to stop marketing and producing an all-flash array, the DSSD D5. This was originally launched by EMC last year. It was a very high-performance storage product. I saw a piece in Storage Review saying the appliance offered 10 million IOPS and 100 gigabyte throughput. The problem is it was also really expensive, a starting price of $1 million. That was just the floor, and then it could go up from there. And so Dell EMC has decided to walk this back.
Yeah, this is we built a Formula One car and then we put it into the market to see, if anybody wanted to take the kids to school in it. It's like, I've heard stories that maybe you could count the number of customers who've bought this product on one hand after over a year, and over $1 billion has been sunk into this product. They actually bought a company called DSSD. And then they've doubled down with an extensive marketing campaign, a massive launch. They've spent all the time putting support and spare parts in place. And so they're probably washing, way more than $1 billion down the drain here to fold this technology into other things. Now, admittedly, they've got a whole bunch of NVMe and a whole bunch of technology that they could port over to the VMAX and the VNX storage products if they wish to. But is kind of embarrassing for EMC because this product was really supposed to take them for the next 30 years. This was going to be the high-performance flash of the future. This was where the VMAX was going to be. And customers just went, we're off. We're going to do scale-out storage because that's fast enough. That's my pitch on it. That Register article sums it up very well. Check the show notes because the Register article sums it up quite accurately, I believe.
When I see all kinds of vendors doing this thing, they come in and they say, we've got this really cool solution and the barrier of entry is $1 million. We got to drop a whole rack of equipment in your facility and it's going to do really cool things. It's going to change your life. And we're like, I don't need my life changed that bad. There's got to be a better strategy to introduce these technologies other than, hey, give us $1 million and trust us. That's what we're hearing in the enterprise.
I can change my life with a six pack or a bottle of champagne, quite honestly. I don't actually need to spend $1 million to get my life improved for a short period of time.
It does seem this was about cutting edge technology with NVMe, which lets you use SSDs and PCIe, so you get super fast performance. But as you mentioned, Greg, it does seem like there is a ceiling on tolerance. Yes, super high performance, but $1 million, that's a hard way to walk in the door.
And that's for a starting point, and that's only for like, you know, a few tens of terabytes.
Yeah.
That's not petabyte class. This thing, if I remember rightly, and I could be wrong, and I apologize, but, you know, whatever, this thing doesn't even do a petabyte of storage. It's a small, very, very, very fast legacy storage array. And quite honestly, I think there are people out there who want that, but, you know, you can go and build these things with Nimble or Simplivity or Scality or any of these other 45 different storage companies that are doing software only on x86. And you just throw a bigger x86 CPU and get some faster storage arrays and more modern PCIe 3 gen buses in those x86 servers. And you know what? You're going to get 60% or 80% of this for 10% of the money. Just why would you?
Yeah, Yvonne, it sounds like you were talking about, we'll stick with good enough.
Yes. I mean, sometimes you have to make that decision. Like, you know, we just don't need it.
All right, this is our last story for today's episode, story 11. The U.S. hits ZTE with a $1 billion fine. Chinese equipment maker ZTE has been fined $1.19 billion by the U.S. Commerce Department for shipping products that included U.S. components and software to Iran and North Korea, which are on an embargo list. So according to terms of the deal, ZTE has to pay $892 million up front, and then I guess the Commerce Department is has a sort of penalty over their heads of another $300 million if they violate again over the next 7 years.
Not much to say here. ZTE deliberately definitely did breach. There's very strong evidence in this case. But of course, it's very difficult to separate the U.S. government from anti-Chinese rhetoric and not to feel that, you know, over the last 5 years, the anti-Chinese sort of thing has been going on. And ZTE is a Chinese company. And you just have to wonder whether the Commerce Department has been zealous in pursuing this because it was a foreign national company and that where they might not have pursued, say, American companies quite so diligently. I don't know if that's true or not, but, you know, for ZTE, certainly if it's been a bad day, $892 million is a lot of money by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, ZTE has a long 25-year plan, 50-year plan to sell to the U.S. This is going to slow that down dramatically. Not happy days, I would imagine.
And just to close this out, the Commerce Department says that this is the largest civil penalty ever levied in an export control case. So not the kind of record you want to be associated with.
Keep a leash on your salespeople. You know, don't let them sell stuff to places where you can't deliver it.
Yeah. Right. This is what I mean. I could just imagine.
How many steak dinners did you buy in Iran? Wait a minute. What,
exactly.
What happened?
Right.
I bet there was, it's one of those things in a, you know, ZTE has been growing massively fast. And it's probably something that happened without any too much conscious effort. Somebody was doing a deal and they said, I just want to do this. And so they bought some stuff and it went, you know, blah, blah, blah. And nobody actually possibly tweaked to the fact. I've seen that sort of stuff happen, but at the end of the day, they did breach what is pretty bad law. Shouldn't have done it. Pay the price. Bad day for them.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
People can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com. On the Twitter is at etherealmind. I do hang around on LinkedIn and Facebook, but I don't actively promote too much there. They're odd places to be. I'd look forward to seeing you.
And we had our guest, Yvonne Sharp. Yvonne, thanks for being with us today. Where can folks find you on the internet?
You can find me on my blog at esharp.net and on Twitter at Sharp Network.
And you've just been putting out a series on SD-WAN lately. It's been pretty good.
Thanks.
Yeah, recommend
it. Coming soon on Viptela, and we'll just continue talking about it as long as people are willing to listen.
Right on. And I'm Drew Connery Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsors, Interop and Thousand Eyes, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share it with your friends. And please check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find out how to sign up for those at packetpushers.net. And don't forget all of the free, fine technical content you'll find at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.